9. He writes, "It won't." She seethes, but she will say nothing and do nothing but wait. "Yes at 9, he writes in a lower horizontal column. He gets up before the waiter can take his order, leaving the crossword puzzle on the counter next to her. She slides it over and opens the newspaper more fully, as if interested in one of the articles. The map and the newspaper will be destroyed and discarded in separate trash bins. She is already looking forward to leaving tonight. She has little doubt that she will perform her task. The only thing she can't control is the weather. She has never prayed in her life, but if she did, she would pray for no rain.
Chapter 10. It is 1:30 p.m. in the Situation Room, cool and soundproof and windowless. "Montejo is going to declare martial law throughout Honduras tomorrow," says Brendan Mohan, my national security advisor. "He's already imprisoned most of his political rivals, but he'll step that up. There's a food shortage, so he'll probably institute price controls to keep the people calm for a few more days until he's in complete control. By our estimate, the Patriotas have an army 200,000 strong next door in Managua, awaiting word. If he doesn't step down..."
"He won't," says Vice President Kathy Brandt.
Mohan, a former general, does not appreciate the interruption, but understands the chain of command. He shrugs his thick shoulders and turns in her direction. "I agree, Madam Vice President. He won't. But he may not be able to hold the military. If he doesn't, he'll be overthrown. If he does, by our estimate, Honduras will be in civil war within a month." I turn to Erica Beatty, the CIA director, a bookish, soft-spoken woman with dark, raccoonish eyes and cropped gray hair. She is a spook through and through, a lifer at the CIA. She was recruited out of college by the agency and became a clandestine officer stationed in West Germany in the 1980s. In 1987, she was abducted by the Stasi, East Germany's state security service, which claimed that she had been caught on their side of the Berlin Wall with a fake passport and architectural drawings of GDR headquarters. She was interrogated and held for nearly a month before the Stasi released her. Stasi's records, made public after the fall of the Wall and the reunification of Germany, showed that she was brutally tortured, but gave up no information. Her days as a clandestine officer over, she moved up the ranks and became one of our nation's foremost experts on Russia, advising the Joint Chiefs and heading the CIA's Central Eurasia Division, which oversaw intelligence operations in the former Soviet satellites and Warsaw Pact countries, and finally serving on the Senior Intelligence Service. She was my campaign's top advisor on Russia. She rarely speaks unless spoken to, but when you wind her up, she can tell you more about President Dmitry Chernikov than Chernikov himself probably could. "What do you think, Erica?" I ask.
"Montejo's playing right into Chernikov's hands," she says. "Chernikov has wanted an inroad into Central America since he took office. This is the best chance to date. Montejo's turning fascist, giving the Patriotas credibility, making them look like freedom fighters and not Russian puppets. He is playing precisely the role that Chernikov scripted for him. Montejo is a coward and a moron."
"But he's our cowardly moron," Kathy says. Kathy's right. We can't let the Russian-backed Patriotas, Chernikov's puppets, into that region. We could declare any overthrow of President Montejo a coup d'etat and cut off all American aid, but how would that help our interest? That would just turn the Honduran government even more strongly against us, and Russia would be happy to gain a foothold in Central America. "Do I have any good options here?" I ask. Nobody can think of one. "Let's do Saudi Arabia next," I say. "What the hell happened?" Erica Beatty handles this one.
The Saudis have arrested several dozen people in what they say was a plot to assassinate King Saud ibn Saud. They apparently recovered weapons and explosives. It never got as far as an attempt on his life, but the Saudis are saying they were in the final stages of putting it together when the Mabahith executed its raids and mass arrests.
Saud ibn Saud is only 35 years old, the youngest son of the former king. Only a year ago, his father reshuffled his leadership and surprised a lot of people by naming Saud the crown prince, next in line to the throne. It made a lot of people in the royal family unhappy, and within 3 months of his elevation, his father died, and Saud ibn Saud became Saudi Arabia's youngest king. It's been a rocky road for him so far. He's overcompensated by using his internal state police, the Mabahith, to crack down on dissidents, and one night several months ago, he executed more than a dozen of them. I didn't like it, but there wasn't much I could do. I need him in that region. His country is our closest ally, and without a stable Saudi Arabia, our influence is compromised. Who's behind it, Erica? Iran? Yemen? Was it in-house?
They don't know, sir. We don't know. The human rights NGOs are claiming there was no assassination plot, that it's just an excuse to round up more of the king's political rivals. We do know that some of the wealthy but less influential members of the royal family have been swept up, too. It's going to be a rough few days there.
We're assisting?
We've offered. So far, they haven't taken us up on it. It's a tense situation.
Unrest in the most stable part of the Middle East. While I'm dealing with this problem at home, it's the absolute last thing I need right now. At 2:30, back in the Oval Office, I say into the phone, Mrs. Kopecky, your son was a hero. We honor his service to this country. I'm praying for you and your family.
He loved his country, President Duncan, she says, her voice trembling. He believed in his mission.
I'm sure he...
I did not, she says. I don't know why we still have to be in that country. Can't they figure out how to run their own stupid country?
Overhead, the lights flicker. A quick blink, blink.
What's with the lights?
I understand, Mrs. Kopecky, I say.
Call me Margaret. Everyone else does, she says. Can I call you John?
Margaret, I say to a woman who's just lost her 19-year-old son. You can call me anything you want.
I know you're trying to get out of Iraq, John, she says. But do more than try. Get the hell out.
3:10 in the Oval Office with Danny Akers and Jenny Brickman, my political advisor. Carolyn walks in and makes eye contact with me and gives a curt, preemptive shake of her head. Still no news. No change. It's hard to concentrate on anything else, but I have no choice. The world isn't going to stop for this threat. Carolyn joins us, taking a seat.
This is from HHS, says Danny. I wasn't in the mood for Health and Human Services Secretary's presentation today, wanting to minimize time spent on non-essential matters, so I had Danny get into the issue and break it down for me.
It's a Medicaid issue, says Danny, involving Alabama. You recall that Alabama was one of the states that refused to accept the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act.
Sure. Carolyn pops up from her seat and rushes to the door, which opens just as she reaches it. My secretary, Joanne, hands her a note. Danny stops talking, probably seeing the expression on my face. Carolyn reads the note and looks at me.
You're needed in the Situation Room, sir, she says.
If it's what we're afraid it is, if this is it, we're hearing about it together for the first time. Chapter 11. 7 minutes later, Carolyn and I enter the Situation Room. We know immediately it isn't what we feared. The attack hasn't commenced. My pulse slows. We're not here for fun and games, but it's not the nightmare. Not yet. In the room as we enter, Vice President Kathy Brandt, my National Security Advisor Brendan Mohan, the Chair of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Rodrigo Sanchez, the Defense Secretary, Dominic Dayton, Sam Haber, the Secretary of Homeland Security, and the CIA Director, Erica Beatty.
They're in a town called Al-Baida, says Admiral Sanchez, central Yemen, not a center of military activity. The Saudi-led coalition is within 100 kilometers.
Why are these two meeting, I ask.
Erica Beatty, CIA, answers,
We don't know, Mr. President, but Abu Dik is al-Shabaab's head of military operations and al-Fadli is the military commander of AQAP.
She raises her eyebrows.
The top generals for the Somali terrorists and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula coming together for a meeting.
Who else is there?
Looks like Abu Dik came with just a small entourage, she says, but al-Fadli brought his family. He always does.
Right, he brings his family along to make himself a harder target.
How many?
7 children, she says, 5 boys, 2 girls, ages 2 to 16, and his wife.
Tell me where they are exactly, not geographically, but in terms of civilians.
They're meeting in an elementary school, she says. Then she quickly adds, but there aren't any kids there right now. Remember, they're 8 hours ahead of us. It's nighttime.
You mean there aren't any kids, I say, besides Al-Fadli's 5 boys and 2 girls.
Of course, sir.
That bastard, using his children as a shield, daring us to kill his entire family to get to him. What kind of coward does that?
There's no chance that Al-Fadli will be separated from his children.
He appears to be in a different part of the school for what that's worth, says Sanchez. The meeting is taking place in some interior office. The children are sleeping in a large space that is probably a gymnasium or assembly room. But the missile will demolish the entire school, I say.
We have to assume it will. Yes, sir.
General Burke, I say into the speakerphone, any comment?
Burke is a 4-star general and head of U.S. Central Command on the phone from Qatar.
Mr. President, you don't need me to tell you that these are 2 high-value targets. They are the best military minds in their respective organizations. Abu Dik is al-Shabaab's Douglas MacArthur. Al-Fadli is not only the top military commander, but also the top strategist for AQAP. This would be significant, sir. We may never have an opportunity like this again.
Significant being a relative term. These men will be replaced, and depending how many innocents we kill, we may create more future terrorists in their wake than we kill right now. But this will be a setback to their organizations, no question. And we can't let terrorists think that they're safe as long as they hide behind their families, either.
Mr. President, says Erica Beatty, we don't know how long this meeting will last. It could be breaking up right now. There's obviously something important that these 2 military commanders want to say to each other or share with each other, and they're afraid to do it through intermediaries or electronically. But for all we know, in 5 minutes they'll be gone.
It's now or never, in other words. Rod, I say to the Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Sanchez, I recommend we strike, he says.
Dom, I say to the Defense Secretary,
I agree.
Brendan?
I agree.
Kathy, I say to the Vice President.
The Vice President takes a quick moment, lets out air, tucks a strand of her gray hair behind her ear.
He made the choice, not us, to use his family as a human shield, she says. I agree that we should strike.
I look at the CIA Director. Erica, do you have the children's names?
She knows me well enough by now. She hands me a piece of paper with 7 names written on it.
I read them. From the 16-year-old boy, Yasin, to the 2-year-old girl, Salma.
Salma, I say aloud. That means peace, doesn't it?
She clears her throat.
I believe it does, sir.
I picture a small child nestled in her mother's arms, sleeping quietly, knowing nothing of a world filled with hate. Maybe Salma will grow up to become the woman who changes it all. Maybe she'll be the one to lead us away from our divisions and toward understanding. We have to believe that can happen someday, don't we? We could wait for the meeting to break up, I say. When they go their separate ways, we follow Abu Dik's convoy and take it out. That's one dead terrorist leader. It's not two, but it's better than zero. And Al-Fadli, asked Chairman Sanchez. We follow his convoy, too, and hope that he separates himself from his family. Then we strike. He won't, sir. Separate himself from his family, I mean. He'll return to a populated area and disappear like he always does. We'll lose him. Al-Fadli rarely comes up for air, says Eric Abadi. That's why this is such a tremendous opportunity. Tremendous. I flip a hen. Yes. Killing seven children feels tremendous. I stand up and move away from my chair, pace along the wall, my back turned to the team. I hear Kathy Brandt's voice. Mr. President, she says, Al-Fadli is no dummy. If we take out Abu Dik within a kilometer or two of where the meeting took place, he'll know you tracked both of them to that elementary school. He'll know why you spared him. He'll spread the word to his brothers in arms. Keep your children close to you, and the Americans won't strike. They don't worry about our children, says Eric Abadi. So we're no different, I ask. We're no better. They don't care about our children. So we don't care about theirs? Kathy raises a hand. No, sir, that's not what I'm saying. They deliberately target civilians. We're not doing it deliberately. We're doing it as a last resort. We are conducting a precision military strike against a terrorist leader, not randomly choosing civilians and children as targets. That's the argument, sure. But the terrorists we're fighting don't see the difference between a military strike conducted by the United States and what they do. They can't drop missiles on us from drones. They can't take on our army, our air force. What they do, blowing up or attacking civilian targets, is their version of a precision military strike. Aren't we different? Don't we draw the line at conducting a military strike that we know will kill innocent children? Unintended consequences are one thing. This time, we know the result before we start. Rod Sanchez checks his watch. This debate could become moot any minute. I doubt they will stay together for very long. Yes, that point was made already, I say. I heard it the first time. I lower my head and close my eyes, shutting out the rest of the room. I have a team of highly competent, well-trained professionals advising me, but I am making this decision alone. There is a reason that the founders of our country put a civilian in charge of the military, because it is not only about military effectiveness. It's about our policy, about values, about what we stand for as a nation. How can I kill seven children? You're not. You're killing two terrorists who are plotting their next slaughter of innocent civilians. Al-Fadli's killing his children by hiding behind them. True, but that's semantics. It's my choice. They live or they die based on my choice. How do I meet my maker one day and justify their deaths? It's not semantics. If you pass on this, you're rewarding them for their cowardly tactics. But that doesn't matter. Seven innocent children are what matters. Is that what the United States stands for? But why are those high-value terrorists meeting in person? That's never happened before. They must be planning something big, something that will result in the death of more than seven children. Stop this now, you might stop an attack. A net saving of lives. I open my eyes, I take a deep breath, waiting for the drumming of my heart to slow. It doesn't. It speeds up. I know the answer. I always knew the answer. I haven't been searching for the answer. I've been searching for a justification. I take one more moment and whisper a prayer. I pray for those children. I pray that one day no president will have to make a decision like this. God help us, I say. You have my authorization to strike. Chapter 12. I return to the Oval Office with Carolyn as the clock slowly, agonizingly approaches 5. We are silent. A lot of working men and women look forward to 5 o'clock on Friday because it signals the end of the work week, some much-needed relaxation and time with the family. But for the last 4 days, Carolyn and I have been waiting and planning for this particular hour of this particular day, not knowing whether it's the beginning of something, the end of something, or both. It was last Monday, just after noon, when I received the phone call on my personal cell. Carolyn and I were grabbing turkey sandwiches in the kitchen. We already knew we were facing an imminent threat. We didn't understand the scope or magnitude of it. We had no idea how to stop it. Our mission in Algeria had already failed in spectacular fashion for all the world to see. Suleiman Jindorak remained on the loose. My entire national security team had been subpoenaed to testify the following day, Tuesday, before the House Select Committee. But when I put down my sandwich and answered that call in the kitchen, everything changed. The dynamic was completely upended. For the first time, I had the tiniest sliver of hope. But I was also more scared than ever. 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Friday, May the 11th, I was told. So as the time approaches 5 o'clock on Friday, May 11, I am no longer thinking about the 7 innocent children in the Republic of Yemen who are dead under a pile of ash and rubble based on a decision I made. Now, I'm wondering what in the hell is about to happen to our country and how I can best deal with it. Where is she? I mumble. It's not quite 5, sir. She'll be here. You don't know that, I say as I pace. You can't know that. Call down. Before she can, her phone buzzes. She answers. Yes, Alex? She... All right. She's alone? Yes, that's fine. Do what you need to do. Yes, but be quick about it. She puts away her phone and looks at me. She's here, I say. Yes, sir, she's here. They're searching her. I look out the window. Up at the bruised sky, threatening rain. What is she going to say, Carrie? I wish I knew, sir. I will be monitoring. The instruction delivered to me was a one-on-one meeting, no exceptions. So I will be alone, physically in the Oval Office, with my guest, but Carolyn will be watching from a monitor in the Roosevelt Room. I bounce on my toes, not knowing what to do with my hands. My stomach is in full-scale revolt. God, I haven't been this nervous since, I can't finish the sentence. I don't think I've ever been this nervous. You don't show it, sir? I nod. Neither do you. Carolyn never shows weakness. It's not her way. And it's a comfort right now because she's the only one I can count on. She's the only person in the U.S. government besides me who knows about this meeting. Carolyn leaves. I stand by my desk and wait for Joanne to open the door for my visitor. After what feels like an endless slog of time, the clock moving in slow motion, Joanne opens the door. Mr. President, she says. I nod. This is it. Show her in, I say. Chapter 13. The girl enters the room wearing work boots, torn jeans, and a gray long-sleeved t-shirt bearing the word Princeton. She is waif-thin, with a long neck, prominent cheekbones, and narrow eyes, eyes spread apart in a way that suggests Eastern Europe. Her hair is one of those styles I've never understood, the right side of her head shaved in a military buzz cut, with longer hair hanging over it, down to her bony shoulders. A cross between a Calvin Klein model and a Eurotrash punk rocker. She scans the room, but not the way most people who enter the Oval Office do. First-time visitors soak it all in, eagerly devour all the portraits and knick-knacks, marvel at the presidential seal, the resolute desk. Not her. What I see in her eyes behind the impenetrable wall of her face is pure loathing, hatred of me. This office, everything it stands for. But she's tense, too, on alert, wondering if someone will jump her, handcuff her, throw a hood over her head. She fits the physical description I received. She gave the name at the gate that we expected. It's her, but I have to confirm regardless. "Say the words," I tell her. She raises her eyebrows. She can't be surprised. "Say it." She rolls her eyes. "Dark ages," she says, curling her R's, as if the words were poison on her tongue. Her accent is heavily Eastern European. "How do you know those words?" She shakes her head, clucks her tongue. There will be no answer to my question. "Your Secret Service does not like me," she says. "Does not like me." You are setting off the metal detectors. "I do that, always. What is your word? The bomb frig? The shrapnel," I say. "Parts of a bomb from an explosion." "This, yes," she says, tapping her forehead. "They told me that 2 centimeters to the right, and I would not have woken up." She curls a thumb into the belt loop of her jeans. There is defiance in her eyes, a challenge. "Would you like to know what I did to deserve it?" I'm going to guess it had something to do with some military strike ordered by an American president. Maybe me, in some faraway land. But I know next to nothing about this woman. I don't know her real name or where she's from. I don't know her motivation or her plan. After first making contact with me, indirectly, 4 days ago, on Monday, she fell off the map. And despite my considerable efforts to learn more about her, I failed. I don't know anything about her for certain. But I am reasonably sure that this young woman holds the fate of the free world in her hands. "I was walking my cousin to mass when the missile hit," she says. I shove my hands in my pockets. "You're safe here," I say. Her eyes drift up and away, enlarging them a beautiful copper color. It makes her look even younger, less of the hardened image she's trying to project and more the scared kid she must be underneath it all. She should be scared. I hope she's scared. I sure as hell am. But I'm not going to show it any more than she will. "No," she says. "I do not think. I do not think. I promise." She blinks her eyes heavily, looks away with disdain. "The American president promises." She reaches into the back pocket of her jeans and produces an envelope, tattered and folded in half. She straightens it and places it on the table next to the couch. "My partner does not know what I know," she says. "Only I do. I did not write it down." She taps the right side of her head. "It is in here only." Her secret, she means. She didn't put it on a computer we could hack or in an email we could intercept. She is storing it in one place only, a place that not even our sophisticated technology can penetrate, her mind. "And I do not know what my partner knows," she says. Right. She has separated herself from her partner. Each of them, she is telling me, holds part of the puzzle. Each of them is indispensable. "I need both of you," I say. "I understand. Your message on Monday was clear about that." "And you will be alone tonight," she says. "Yes, your message was clear on that too." She nods as if we have settled something. "How do you know Dark Ages?" I ask again. Her eyes turn down. From the table by the couch, she picks up a photograph of my daughter and me walking from Marine One toward the White House.
"I remember the first time I saw a helicopter," she says. "I was a young girl. It was on the television. There was a hotel in Dubai that was opening. The Mary Poseidon, it was called. This majestic hotel on the waters of the Persian Gulf, it had a helipad.
"A helipad, yes," I say. "A rooftop landing for helicopters."
"This, yes. The helicopter landed on the roof of this hotel. I remember thinking that if people could fly, they could do anything.
I'm not sure why she's telling me about Dubai hotels or helicopters. Maybe it's nothing more than nervous chatter. I approach her. She turns, puts down the photo, and steals herself.
If I do not leave here, she says, you will never see my partner. You will have no way to stop this.
I lift the envelope from the table. It is nearly weightless, flimsy. I can see a trace of color through the paper. The Secret Service would have inspected it, checked it for any suspicious residue and the like. She steps back, still wary, still waiting for government agents to burst through the door and whisk her away to some Guantanamo Bay-style interrogation room. If I thought that would work, I'd do it in a heartbeat. But she has set this up so that it wouldn't. This young woman has managed to do something that very few people could pull off. She has forced me to play this game on her terms. What do you want? I ask. Why are you doing this? For the first time, her stoic expression breaks. Her lips curve. But it's not an expression of mirth.
Only the president of this country could ask such a question.
She shakes her head. Then her face once again becomes a poker face wall.
You will find out why,
she says, nodding toward the envelope in my hand. Tonight. So I have to trust you, I say. This draws a look from her, a raised eyebrow, her eyes glistening.
I have not convinced you.
You've gotten this far, I say, but no, you haven't entirely convinced me. She eyeballs me, a confident, daring look, like I'd be a fool to call her bluff.
Then you must decide, she says.
Wait, I say as she heads for the door, reaches for the knob. She bristles, freezes in place, still looking at the door, not me. She says,
if I am not allowed to leave, you will never see my partner. If I am followed, you will never see my partner.
No one's going to stop you, I say. No one's going to follow you. She holds still, her hand poised over the knob, thinking, debating. About what, I don't know. I could fill a room with what I don't know.
If anything happens to my partner, she says, your country will burn.
She turns the knob and leaves. Just like that, she's gone. And then I'm alone with the envelope. I have to let her go. I have no choice. I can't risk alienating the one chance I have. Assuming I believe her, assuming that everything she's saying is true, I'm nearly 100% there, but in my line of work, it's hard to get closer than that. I open the envelope, which tells me where the next meeting will take place tonight. I replay everything that just happened. So very little did. She had almost nothing of substance to say. She accomplished two things, I realize. One, she needed to hand me this envelope, and two, she wanted to know if she could trust me, if I would let her leave. I walk over and sit on my couch, staring at the envelope, trying to glean any hints from what she said, trying to think ahead on the chessboard. A knock on the door, and Carolyn enters. I passed her test, I say. That's all this was, she agrees. And that, she adds, nodding at the envelope in my hand. But did she pass mine? I ask. How do I know this is real? I think it is, sir. Why? Overhead, the lights flicker again, a momentary strobe effect. Carolyn looks up and curses under her breath. Another thing she'll have to address sometime down the road. Why do you believe her? I ask. The reason it took me a few minutes to come in, sir. She points at her phone. We just got word out of Dubai. There was an incident.
An incident in Dubai.
With a helicopter? She nods. A helicopter exploded while landing on the helipad of the Mary Poseidon Hotel. I bring a hand to my face. I checked the timing, sir. It happened after she'd walked into the Oval Office. There's no other way she could have known about it. I fall back against the couch. So she accomplished a third goal. She showed me she was the real deal. All right, I whisper. I'm convinced.
Chapter 14. Up in the private residence, I open one of the dresser drawers, which contains only a single item, a picture of Rachel. I have plenty of those around here. Photos of her vibrant and happy, mugging for the camera, or hugging, or laughing. This one is for me only. It was taken less than a week before she died. Her face is blotchy from treatments. She has only wisps of hair on her head. Her face is almost skeletal. To most people, this would be hard to look at. Rachel Carson Duncan, at her absolute worst, finally succumbing to a ravaging disease. But to me, it's Rachel at her best, her strongest, her most beautiful. The smile in her eyes, her peace and resolve. The fight was over at that point. It was just a matter of time, they told us. Could be months, but more likely weeks. It turned out to be 6 days. It was 6 days I wouldn't trade for any others in my life. All that mattered was us, our love. We talked about our fears. We talked about Lily. We talked about God. We read from the Bible and prayed and laughed and cried until our wells of tears had run dry. I'd never known intimacy so raw and cathartic. I'd never felt so inseparable from another human being. "Let me take a picture of you," I whispered to her. She started to object, but she understood. I wanted to remember this time because at that moment, I never loved her more. "Sir," says Carolyn Brock, lightly rapping her knuckles on the door. "Yeah, I know." I put my fingers to my lips, then touch Rachel's photo. I close the drawer and look up. "Let's go," I say, dressed in my civvies and holding a small bag over my shoulder. Alex Trimble's head drops, his jaw clenched with disapproval. When the head of a Secret Service detail dreams his worst nightmare, it is this. He can always console himself for the fact that I gave him an order, that he had no choice but to let me go. "Just a loose perimeter," he says. "You'll never see us." I give him a smile that says no. Alex has been with me since I was first assigned security protection during the primaries, when I was a governor viewed as a long shot for the nomination. It wasn't until the first major debate that my poll numbers surged, placing me in the top tier of candidates behind the front runner, Kathy Brandt. I didn't know how the Secret Service doled out its assignments, but I had assumed as a dark horse candidate that I did not receive their best and brightest, that Alex always said to me, "Governor, as far as I'm concerned, you are the president." And he was disciplined and organized. His team feared him the same way cadets fear their drill sergeants. And as I told him when I made him head of the White House detail, nobody killed me, so he must have done something right. You don't get too close to your security, and they don't get too close to you. Each side of the arrangement understands the need for emotional separation. But I've always seen the goodness in Alex. He married his college sweetheart, Gwen. He reads the Bible every day and sends money to his mother back home every month. He's the first to tell you that he wasn't book smart, but he was a hell of a left tackle and got a football scholarship to Iowa State, where he studied criminal justice and dreamed of joining the Secret Service so he could do in life what he did on the gridiron, protect the blind side of his client. When I asked him to head up my detail at the White House, he kept his standard stoic expression and ramrod posture, but I caught a brief sheen of emotion across his eyes. "It would be the greatest honor of my life, sir," he whispered. "We'll use GPS," he says to me now, "just so we'll know where you are." "Sorry," I say. "Checkpoints," he tries a Hail Mary. "Just tell us where you're going." "No, Alex," I say. He doesn't understand why. He is convinced that he could surveil me invisibly. I'm sure he could. So why won't I let him? He doesn't know, and I can't tell him. "At least wear a bulletproof vest," he says. "No," I answer, "too noticeable. Even the new ones are too bulky." Alex wants to argue more. He wants to tell me that I'm being a horse's ass, but he'd never speak to me like that. He runs through an entire plea in his head, probably no different from the arguments he's already raised with me, before dropping his shoulders and relenting. "Be safe," he says, a line that people throw out every day as an innocuous sign-off, but that in this case is charged with emotion and dread. "Will do." I look at Danny and Carolyn, the only other people in the room. It's time for me to go, alone and off the record. For years I've been constantly going, but never alone and never off the record. The Secret Service takes every step with me, and at least one aide is almost always there, even when I'm on vacation. A record is kept of where I am every hour. I know that this is the only option that will spare the country untold misery and allow me to do my duty to preserve, protect, and defend it. I know my fellow Americans go alone and off the record all the time, though surveillance cameras, cell phones, social media mining, and hacking are shrinking their zones of privacy, too. Still, this is a big change, and I feel a little disoriented and disarmed. Danny and Carolyn are by my side for the last leg of my dislocation from their trappings of office. We are quiet. They each tried hard to talk me out of this. Now they're resigned, helping me make it work. It's harder than you might think to get out of the White House unnoticed. We take the stairs from the residence all the way down. We walk slowly, each footfall another movement toward what is about to happen. With every step, I am surrendering more control to an uncertain fate tonight. "You remember when we first took this route?" I ask, recalling our post-election tour before I took the oath of office. "Like it was yesterday," says Carolyn. "I'll never forget it," Danny says. "We were so full of hope, I guess. We were so sure we'd make the world a better place." Carolyn says, "Maybe you were. I was scared to death." "I was, too. We knew the world we were inheriting. We had no illusions that we would leave everything perfect. When I hit the pillow every night during those heady pre-inaugural days, my mind would veer wildly from dreams of massive strides forward in national security, foreign relations, shared prosperity, and health care, and criminal justice reform to nightmares of completely botching the whole thing and plunging the nation into crisis. "Safer, stronger, fairer, kinder," Danny says, reminding me of the four words I ticked off every morning as we began to put fine points on our policies and build our team for the upcoming four-year term. Finally, we reach the sub-basement, where there's a one-lane bowling alley, a bunker-like but well-furnished operations center that Dick Cheney occupied after 9/11, and a couple of other rooms designed for meeting around simple tables or sleeping on cots. We pass the doors and head toward a narrow tunnel that connects the building to the Treasury Department, just to the east, on 15th and Pennsylvania. What exactly is beneath the White House has been the subject of myth and rumor going back to the Civil War, when the Union Army feared an attack on the White House and plans were put together to evacuate President Lincoln to a vault in the Treasury building as a last resort. The real work on the tunnel didn't begin until FDR and World War II, when an air assault on the White House became a real possibility. It was designed in a zigzag pattern precisely to mitigate the impact of a bomb strike. The entrance to the tunnel has a door alarm, but Carolyn's taken care of that. The tunnel itself is only 10 feet wide and 7 feet high. Not a lot of headroom for someone like me, who's over 6 feet tall. It could have a claustrophobic effect, but I don't feel it. For someone no longer accustomed to going anywhere without the Secret Service or aides, the empty open space of the tunnel is liberating. The three of us walk almost the length of the tunnel before coming to another path, which turns right into a small underground parking garage reserved for high-ranking Treasury officials and important guests. Tonight, it also holds my getaway car. Carolyn hands me car keys, then a cell phone, which I put in my left pocket next to the envelope that the girl gave me half an hour ago. "The numbers are pre-programmed," she says, referring to the cell phone. "Everyone we talked about, including Lily." "Lily." Something breaks inside of me. "You remember the code?" she asks. "I remember. Don't worry." From behind my back, I produce an envelope of my own, this one bearing the presidential seal and containing a single piece of paper. When Danny sees it, he almost loses his composure. "Nope," he says. "I am not opening that." Carolyn puts out her hand and takes it from me. "Open it," I tell her, "if you need to open it." Danny puts a hand on his forehead, pushing his hair back. "Jesus, John," he whispers, "the first time since I took office that he's used my name."
"Are you really going to do this?"
"Danny," I whisper, "if anything happens to me..."
Hey now. He puts his hands on my shoulders. He is faltering, holding back emotion.
"She's like flesh and blood to me. You know that. I love that kid more than anything."
Danny's divorced now, with one son in grad school. But he was in the waiting room when Lily was born. He stood on the altar at her baptism. He teared up at every one of her graduations. He held Lily's other hand at Rachel's funeral. Early on, he was Uncle Danny to Lily. Somewhere along the line, the uncle part got dropped. He will be the closest thing she'll have to a parent.
"You got your ring you're going?" he asked.
"What, you're popping me with a coin shack right now?" I pat my pocket. "Never go anywhere without it," I say. "What about you?"
"Can't say I have mine. Guess I owe you a drink."
"So now you..." His voice catches with emotion. "Now you have to come back." I hold my stare on Danny, my family, not in blood, but in every way that matters. "Roger that, brother." Then I turn to Carolyn. We don't have a hugging kind of relationship, other than the nights I won the nomination and then the general election. We've never embraced. But we do now. She whispers into my ear. "My money's on you, sir. They don't know what they're up against." "If that's true," I say back, "it's because I have you on my side." I watch them leave, shaken but resolved. The next 24 or 48 hours will not be easy for Carolyn, who will have to serve as my point person at the White House. These are unprecedented times. We are, in a real sense, making this up as we go along. When they are gone, when I am alone in the tunnel, I bend over and put my hands on my knees. I take a few deep breaths to combat the butterflies. "I hope you know what the hell you're doing," I say to myself. Then I turn and head further into the tunnel. Chapter 15. I walk into Treasury's underground parking garage with my head angled downward, hands in the pockets of my blue jeans, my leather shoes moving softly along the asphalt. I am not the only person down here at this hour, so my presence is not conspicuous by any means, though I'm dressed more casually than the departing employees of the Treasury Department with their suits and briefcases and ID badges. It's easy to hide among the sounds of heels clicking on pavement, car remotes beeping, automatic locks on cars releasing and engines turning over, especially when the departing employees are more concerned with their weekend plans than with the guy in the cotton button-down and blue jeans. I may be in hiding, and this is no joyride, but I can't deny the small thrill of release I feel while moving about in public without being noticed. It has been more than a decade since I've set foot in a public place without being on display, without feeling like someone might snap a photo of me at any moment, without seeing dozens of people wanting to approach me for a handshake or a quick hello, a selfie, a favor, or even a substantive policy discussion. As promised, the car is the fourth from the end on the left, a nondescript sedan, an older model, silver, with Virginia plates. I hold out the remote and push the unlock button for too long, causing every door to unlock and then a series of beeps to sound. I'm out of practice. I haven't opened my own car door for a decade. Behind the wheel, I feel like someone fresh out of a time machine, transported into the future by this mysterious contraption. I adjust the seat, turn the ignition, gun the gas once, throw it into reverse, and turn my head to look back, my arm over the passenger seat. As I slowly back out of the space, the car emits a beep that grows more urgent. I hit the brakes and see a woman walking behind the car on the way to hers. Once she has passed by, the beeping stops. Some kind of radar, an anti-collision device. I look back at the dashboard and notice a backup camera. so I can drive in reverse while facing forward watching the screen? They didn't have that 10 years ago, or if they did, my car sure as hell didn't have it. I navigate the sedan through the garage. The lane's surprisingly narrow, the angle's sharp. It takes me a few minutes to get the hang of it again. Jumping forward too abruptly, braking too harshly. But then, it feels like yesterday that I was 16, driving that beater Chevy off the lot of Crazy Sam Kelsey's new and used autos for $1,200. I watch the cars in front of me in the line to leave the garage. The gate lifts automatically as each car reaches the front. No need for the driver to reach out the window to press a card against some reader or anything like that. It occurs to me that I didn't even think to ask about that. When it's my turn at the front, the gate rises, letting me leave. I pull slowly up the ramp, approaching the daylight, wary of passing pedestrians, before I pull into the street. Traffic is thick, so my urge to gun the car to feel the freedom of this temporary independence is stymied by the congestion at every intersection. I look up through the windshield at the bruised sky, hoping it won't rain. The radio. I click a knob to turn it on, and nothing happens. I push a button, and nothing happens. I push another button, and the sound blares out, sending a shockwave through me as two people are arguing, talking over each other about whether President Jonathan Duncan has committed an impeachable offense. I push the same button, kill the sound, and focus on driving. I think about where I'm going, the person I'm about to see, and invariably, my mind wanders back. Chapter 16. Professor Waite strolled across the well of the lecture hall, hands clasped behind his back. And what was the point of Justice Stevens' dissent? He returned to the lectern, looked over his name chart. Mr. Duncan. He looked up at me. Shit. I'd thrown a lump of Copenhagen in my cheek so I could stay awake after a night of getting my paper done. I'd only skimmed the case for today. I was 1 of 100 in this class, after all, so the odds of my being called on were slim. But this was my unlucky day. I was on the spot and unprepared. Justice Stevens disagreed with the majority in... with... I flipped through the pages, feeling the heat rise to my face. Well, yes, Mr. Duncan, dissents do typically disagree with the majority. I do believe that's why they're called dissents. Nervous laughter rippled through the lecture hall. Yes, sir, he disagreed with the majority's interpretation of the Fourth Amendment. You must be confusing Justice Stevens' dissent with Justice Brennan's dissent, Mr. Duncan. Justice Stevens' dissent did not so much as mention the Fourth Amendment. Well, yes, I am confused. I mean, confusing. I think you had it right the first time, Mr. Duncan. Ms. Carson, would you be so kind as to rescue us from Mr. Duncan's confusion? Justice Stevens' point was that the Supreme Court should not intervene in state court decisions that, at worst, would have the effect of raising the floor of the federal constitution. Burned for the first time by the notorious Professor Waite, this being only the fourth week of my first year at UNC Law, I looked across the room at the woman in the third row who was speaking as I thought to myself, "This is the last time you come to class unprepared, you maggot." And then I fixed my gaze on her, seated in the third row, confidently, almost casually giving her answer. It is a floor, not a ceiling, and so long as an adequate and independent state ground exists for the decision, I felt like the wind had been knocked out of me. "Who is that?" I whispered to Danny, seated next to me. Danny was 2 years ahead of me in school. He was the third year, and he knew pretty much everyone. "That's Rachel," he whispered back. "Rachel Carson, a 3L, the one who beat me out for editor-in-chief of the Law Review." "What's her story?" "You mean, is she single?" "No idea. You made a great first impression, though." My heart was still pounding as the class ended. I jumped out of my seat and hit the door, hoping to catch her in the hallway amid a sea of students. Cropped chestnut hair,
jean jacket. Rachel Carson. Rachel Carson. There, I spotted her. I navigated the crowd and caught up to her just as she was breaking away from the forward movement of the masses and angling toward one of the doors. "Hey," I said, my voice shaky. My voice was shaky? She turned and looked at me. Liquid green eyes, eyebrows raised, most delicate, sculpted face I'd ever seen. "Hi," she said tentatively, trying to place me. "Hi." I hiked my backpack over my shoulder. I just wanted to say thanks for, bailing me out in there. "Oh, no problem. You're a 1L? "Guilty as charged." "Happens to all of us," she said. I took a breath. "So, what are you, what are you, doing right now?" What the hell was wrong with me? I'd taken every smoke session Sergeant Melton could dish out. I'd been waterboarded, beaten, strung up, and mock executed by the Iraqi Republican Guard. Suddenly, I was tongue-tied? "Right now? Well, I..." She nodded to one side. For the first time, I focused on the door she'd been about to enter. The ladies' bathroom. "Oh, you were gonna... Yeah. You... Should, then." "Should I?" she said, amused. "Yeah, I mean, it's not good to hold it in, or, if you gotta go, you gotta go, right?" What in the holy hell was wrong with me? "Right," she said. "So, it was nice meeting you." I could hear her laughter inside the bathroom. A week after I first laid eyes on her, I hadn't been able to get her out of my mind. I scolded myself. The first year of law school is the year to buckle down, the year when you establish yourself. But no matter how hard I tried to focus on the minimum contacts doctrine of personal jurisdiction, or the elements of a negligence claim, or the mirror image rule of contract law, that girl in the third row of my federal jurisdiction elective kept popping into my head. Danny gave me intel. Rachel Carson was from a small town in western Minnesota. Went to Harvard undergrad and was at UNC Law on a public interest grant. She was editor-in-chief of the Law Review, first in her class, and had a job waiting for her at a nonprofit organization that provides legal assistance to the poor. She was sweet, but quiet. She kept a low profile socially, tended to hang out with the older people in school who didn't come straight from undergrad. Well, shit, I thought to myself, I didn't come straight from undergrad either. I eventually mustered my courage and found her in the library, sitting at a long table with several of her friends. I told myself again that this was a bad idea. My legs had a different notion, though, and suddenly I was standing by her table. When she saw me coming, she put down the pen in her hand and stared. I wanted to do this in private, but I was afraid that if I didn't do it now, I'd never do it. So go on, you dumbass, before someone calls security. I removed the piece of paper from my pocket, unfolded it, and cleared my throat. By now, I had the entire table's attention. I started reading. "The first two times you heard me speak, I sounded like a fool. I made about as much sense as a top hat on a mule. I wasn't sure a third attempt would do me any better, so I decided that I put my thoughts down in a letter." I peeked at her, an amused smile flirting with her face. "She hasn't walked away yet," I said, getting a chuckle from one of her friends. "A good start." "My name is John. I come from here, a town near Boomer. I have good manners, listen well, a decent sense of humor. I have no money, have no car, no talent as a poet, but I do possess a working brain, though I often fail to show it." That line got me another chuckle from my friends. "It's true," I said to Rachel. "I can read and write and all that junk." "I'm sure, I'm sure. May I keep going?" "By all means," she swept her hand.
You're here to study, says my buddy. Remember Professor Waite? But for some reason, I just can't concentrate. I'm reading the section on equal protection, the law, and racial quotas, but instead I'm thinking of a green-eyed girl from Minnesota. She couldn't suppress her smile, her face coloring. The rest of the women at the table applauded. I bowed at the waist.
Thank you very much.